This is where the other thing which Trump said on Fox and Friends today is extremely important. He said, we're going to unify the nation by succeeding. Well, what does succeeding mean? It means in breaking the grip of British imperial economics on the United States and potentially on the world and unleashing an era of unprecedented economic development for everybody on this planet by crushing the British Empire. This U.S.-Russia alliance is the biggest thing that's happened in 100 years from the standpoint of the British Empire. This is what finishes them off, and they know it.
The age of consensus politics is over. ARC, ARC, the America, Russia, China, and the British are doing everything imaginable to stop that from happening. This is where we are. This is the situation, and everybody better, you know, buckle up, buttercup, because this is not going to play out the way you think it's going to play out.
If you don't have massive economic development, break people out of, you know, this world of perpetual religious warfare that the British have created, you're not going to solve it. And
is that this jihadi Islam and this extremist, fanatical Jewish factions are all products of British foreign policy. Israel was the creation of the British Empire. Just a few days ago, J.D. Vance, just after the Russian drones, he went on OAN Network with Matt Gaetz. And J.D. Vance said, like, we see no reason to continue to hold sanctions against Russia.
You said that? I missed that.
You know, one of the things that strikes me is how meticulous each of you is in terms of the research that you do and then what you bring in order to educate and inform others. So thank you very much.
So I'm learning after all these years. I'm finally.
My work here is done, my friend. I can do this job from home.
Meet NordVPN. It's an all-inclusive cybersecurity and privacy kit for every day and everyone.
When tyranny becomes law, rebellion becomes a duty. So said Thomas Jefferson. Go to bit.ly/lawfultaxprotest or bit.ly/makewarhistory and find out why it is a criminal offense to pay central government or local government taxes in the UK. And let's make war history. Hey, Susan. Hey, Tom. Hey, Alex. And hello from Rich. It is Friday, the 12th of September. It is 7:37 p.m. UK time as I start this conversation. This is our second conversation, a star chamber, Susan, Tom, Alex, and me bringing up the rear.
And that has very evil connotations, by the way. Star chamber, supposed to be star-studded.
It's all coming out. It's all
Starry
coming
night.
Out.
I could pick any other.
Okay.
I already get accused of being an Israeli like cuck on a regular basis. I don't need star chamber. Like
okay, fine. Right. Not sorry, star chamber. Sorry. Whoops. But I won't edit that out. And I'm gonna do very quick introductions, and I will have all the links. Susan from Promethean Action, absolutely fabulous analyst. You got to follow them on YouTube, on X, and listen to their. Just they're really, really great analysis reports. Very short, fabulous stuff. And they do a live on Thursdays. Tom Luongo, Gold Guts and Guns and Me. And he's incredibly badly behaved on X. Well worth following. But great macro and analysis. Mr. Alex Craner, I think I've met him before. And he's a great analyst and also trend research follower with his trend system of making money and stuff. Yeah, Naked Hedgy on X. Oh, that was really bad. Oh, and there's me. There you go. So Susan, let's kick off this conversation.
Well, I mean, obviously, the world is very much focused on the assassination of Charlie Kirk. And I think it's important for people to kind of settle themselves and not go off on a cocked hat on every single possibility. I want to actually start with what Donald Trump said on Fox and Friends today, because I think that's really a very good place to start. Of course, a suspect has been arrested and identified, et cetera, et cetera, et cetera. But what President Trump said today, because I mean, you've all seen it, you know, they're going to try and cover it up. They're going to pretend he's a lone assassin. Well, this investigation has just started, first of all. And there's going to be a state investigation and there's going to be a federal investigation. You know, whether there are other parties involved, which everybody kind of presumes, you know, that is the kind of thing where you've got to be very deliberate in terms of building an actual case. So I think people need to have a little bit of patience in terms of how this plays out at the moment. But I think what President Trump said today on Fox and Friends is much more significant, because there's two ways you're going to hone in on the apparatus which does this kind of thing. One is you have a case where you build the case from the bottom up, And the other is you recognize how it operates from the top down. So what did Trump say on Fox and Friends today? They're considering opening up a RICO investigation of George Soros and his son. Yeah. Now, I suspect that if they do that, it's not just going to be George Soros. It will be broader than that. But it's a very clear recognition that, obviously, this is not random violence. This is an orchestrated attack on the United States. All of us on this show know that ultimately all roads are going to lead to London. How quickly you are going to unravel that remains to be seen. But I think the fact that he said that indicates that you've got a very serious intention to begin to go to the higher levels of this. Now, people may be familiar with the ebook that Promethean Action has on its website. If you go to our toolkit, I'll do a little advertising right now.
Please.
It's entitled, It is the British Who Murder Our Presidents. And we take the case of Abraham Lincoln, William McKinley, John Kennedy, and then the attacks on Donald Trump prior to his return to office. Actually, I think it was published prior to the assassination attempt of July 2024. But it shows that there's a commonality in terms of those three assassinations and the attacks on Trump. And I think this is where the other thing which Trump said on Fox and Friends today is extremely important. He said, we're going to unify the nation by succeeding. You know, it's not a question of unifying the nation by everybody holding hands. That's probably better than shooting at each other, but that's not going to unify the nation. He said, we're going to unify the nation by succeeding. Well, what does succeeding mean? It means him succeeding in breaking the grip of British imperial economics on the United States and potentially on the world and unleashing an era of unprecedented economic development for everybody on this planet by crushing the British Empire. And that's how you have to look at this. I mean, the ebook that we put together on the British assassinating our presidents, it shows that there is a direct thread from Abraham Lincoln, who revived the American system of Alexander Hamilton, to William McKinley, who continued the American system of Alexander Hamilton, to John Kennedy, who, without being directly in that tradition by name, was carrying out the same kind of anti-imperial, pro-growth, pro-science, pro-human economic policies, and then Donald Trump. This is, in order to understand where, in order to truly get to the bottom of assassinations, you have to understand what it is they really hate. And it is the philosophical underpinning of the American system, of Christianity. I might add to that Plato. I made the reference in our live show yesterday that Socrates was executed for corrupting the youth. It's an amazing parallel to Charlie Kirk. His corruption was that he was attempting to free the young people of Athens from the false way of thinking, which was destroying their nation, their city. That's what Charlie Kirk was doing. He was freeing people from the false assumptions that have been destroying our nation and destroying society. It's that method of dialogue. It's as many people have said, his Christian faith. It is ultimately that he was contributing to building the MAGA movement and giving President Trump such a foundation, especially potentially from younger generations, that Trump's policies of taking on the empire, of restoring the American system of political economy, would not only succeed, but would clearly outlast Trump's presidency. And I think people have to put their minds in that place while they think about this, because if you live in, you know, the blogosphere, if, you know, you sit there doom scrolling the latest theory of who's covering up what, or who did this, or who can we point to, you're going to have a very bad weekend.
Very good. Thank you.
I'll make it this quick, and then I'll turn it over to Alex. So I'm going to say, Susan, I just went on this exact same rant on my back porch while doom scrolling my Twitter feed and watching the fake news work itself out all afternoon. And I literally was talking to my wife and a friend of mine who was staying with us briefly, and we were chatting about this. I said, guys, this is what this is about. Kirk was. They had to stop it in the bud now that they had to stop the conversion of Zoomer men and the young generations from becoming fully actualized people. And they had to stop that now. And he, you know, Charlie Kirk went into the den. Like I always pay Charlie Kirk like a very small amount of direct attention, because I always looked at him as kind of, you know, kind of like a gateway drug. Like, doesn't not germane to the kind of work that myself, Alex, and that we do, where we're on the edge of the zeitgeist. Charlie Kirk was like taking the zeitgeist and trying to normalize it and bring it and bring it, you know, bring the middle space into the ground up. So we always kind of just kind of, you know, like me and my friends were like, yeah, you know, he's fine, but you know, he's not all that interesting. He's kind of, you know, base level. But when you think about what he represents in the context of what Susan just talked about, he was one of the most dangerous men in America. And I hadn't really given him a second thought until this happened. And I was, you know, watching my Twitter feed and I like saw the video. I'm like, whoa. And then immediately started to spin off. And I'm like, yeah, they're very clearly having to, my initial thought was, this was a message from somebody. Oh, by the way, Donald Trump, if you don't get on board with Ukraine and this and everything else, because that was all happening at the same time as the Russian drone story was hitting Poland, you know, all that was breaking, and Ursula von der Leyen was giving her her State of the Union address, which frankly should have been, you know, issued in the original German. Like, there's so many things that happened in that 24-hour period, it was very clear that this was also something that needed to be said and done as kind of an exclamation point. Oh, by the way, Trump, we're taking out another layer of your support. Because at the same time, I watched the Graper crew like everywhere. I saw it on 4chan. I saw it on my Twitter feed. I saw all of it. It's all the Jews. It's all this. They were trying so hard to pin this thing on Israel, like immediately. It was insane. And I haven't seen anything like that since 10/7, or sorry, since 10/8. Okay, where all of a sudden it was okay to start criticizing Israel in public again. Now, again, this is not to absolve Israel of any of the things that they have done or continue to do. That's not what this is about. But it's about the idea that you have to try and tie this to Israel, because that is Donald Trump's weakness on the political stage right now. His weakness is his support of Israel, right? And I've always said that, you know, during the campaign last year, I said they're going to use this against him. That's why they were spinning up all the pro-Palestinian protests on college campuses and everything else. So Trump's relationship with Israel has always been his Achilles heel, you know, from a domestic policy perspective, from a zeitgeist perspective. And it's been used to try and cleave off bits and pieces of his support. And the funny part about what happened with Charlie Kirk is that that's not going to land. Because we're watching the turn. They were expecting us to go violent on this. They were trying, they had their Nick Fuentes and their Ian Carrolls and all those Graper sons of bitches out in force trying to gin up the violence and the hate and the this and that and everything else. And what are people doing? They're going, nope, I'm leaving. The normies in the center are all rallying around. Oh, that's it. I can't support the Democrats anymore. I can't do this anymore. I cannot. This is not acceptable. This is not America. What in the actual, right? And I see 10 of those for every one of the other ones. And the way that people are responding so far has been cautiously optimistic that it's not going to degenerate into a kind of Fremen-esque, you know, jihad against the other side. Because as Alex likes to point out to us, I'm going to turn it over to Alex in just a second so he can expound on this idea about the ant jar. Right? We get the red ants and the black ants, we put them in a jar, we shake it up, and then we hope that they all fight and kill each other while the superstructure is laid. Well, nothing changes outside the jar, and the superstructure is laid for the future. So I think that was their plan, and our response to that has been cautiously optimistically, as of the night of the 12th of September, exactly not that. We didn't go burn down cities. We didn't start, you know, firebombing, you know, abortion clinics or anything along those lines. No, people got together, held silent vigils, you know. And then this all happens on you know, a couple of days after Irina Perutska, that video makes it out into the world. And it was literally happening in the same day, because this was on Wednesday, that morning for my market report. Again, that morning there was the guy put out on Twitter that I want to raise $500,000 to give art grants to make murals of Irina and paint them all over American cities. And then Elon Musk comes in and says, I pledge $1 million. And I'm like, that is the way you deal with this. You say, that's not going to happen again. We are not going to live like this. We have to change the rhetoric from we shouldn't have to live like this to we will not live like this. And if we change that, if that's the message that we are in, that we hold inside of us, that will put a limit on the potential for downstream political violence, but at the same time, also then turn this into something potentially constructive on the other side of it. And from what little I knew of Charlie Kirk, that would be what he would have wanted. So I will leave it there. Alex.
Thank you, sir. Well, I actually don't have a whole lot to say about the assassination of Charlie Kirk, other than maybe the fact that he was killed in such a public way. You know, if somebody wanted, if somebody just wanted him dead, it would have been much easier to kill him anywhere else. He went around without security. He was not a difficult target. And then if you want to shoot in a very highly public event, where there's thousands of people, potentially security, police, ambulances, and so forth, you're taking extra risk. And somebody obviously decided to take the extra risk because I think, as you pointed out, this was a message. It wasn't just getting rid of Charlie Kirk, and it was probably a message to Trump. And I expect that it won't have the desired effect. It will probably have the opposite effect. And I think that in general, the war party, the globalists, are on the back foot, and they are now simply overdoing it. They're doing too much because they're running out of time. Ukraine's going to fall. Israel is on super thin ice. They haven't managed to trigger another bigger war somewhere, even though they're working on that too. And they've clearly lost the United States. So this is what I see as developments. And then, you know, the summit in Alaska was a very, very significant event. Vladimir Putin spoke about the summit in Alaska at the Eastern Economic Forum, where he said that the news was received very well at the SCO, and that nobody uttered a word of criticism against Trump at the SCO meeting. And then we had two very interesting postings by Kirill Dmitriev. Yeah. In one of them, he kind of posted those two pictures to his Instagram followers, who are mostly Russians, saying, which picture is better, India, China, and Russia sitting around the table as friends, or India, China, Russia, and the United States sitting around the table as friends? And 77% of his followers, which are pretty much all Russian, responded the one with the United States involved. And then in a different post, he said that Donald Trump and Vladimir Putin will prevent the World War III from breaking out. And what's interesting about this tweet was that he didn't say might or should or could. He said will. And that to me suggests, you know, because Russians generally aren't, they don't do a lot of trash talk. They're very careful about the words they use. And the fact that he used the word will tells me that, which is what I suspected all along, that the cooperation and policy coordination between the United States and Russia is far more extensive than we know, that they are in agreement about what the challenges are, who the enemy is, and how to confront them. And they know that the enemy's only way to preserve themselves is to trigger World War III and to set the whole world on fire. Mm-hmm. And Kirill Dmitriev says, Trump and Putin will prevent this from happening. And then just, you know, for the benefit of the viewers, Kirill Dmitriev is not just a random Russian person. He's the head of the Russian Sovereign Wealth Fund. He is the point man for economic and financial developments for Russia and internationally. He has strong Western credentials, and so he's one of the very top advisors to Vladimir Putin. And he was one of the people present at the summit in Alaska.
Mm-hmm. Thank you, Alex. I'm a little bit confused, and we don't need to go into this, like who really, really did it. I don't think it was this patsy that they found, this guy that they found, I've forgotten his name, Tony something, that all of a sudden he did it. I was swayed by all the stuff that's saying it was the Israelis, and now I think, Susan, what you were suggesting is something else, like that's all a misdirection.
Well, I think we just don't know. And I think the most important thing, I mean, it's been what, 48 hours? it's been 12 hours since maybe they caught, or 15 hours since they caught this particular guy, who I suspect was involved. Maybe he was the main shooter. Maybe there were other shooters and so on. It is so early.
Yeah.
You know, they, one of the things that Kash Patel said is, you know, they flew boatloads of people into Utah to start collecting the evidence and take it back to Quantico. You know, it's not sitting, it's not all sitting in some, you know, state police office in Utah. The federal investigation is going to be an extremely, I believe, I mean, anybody who thinks that Kash Patel is going to cover this up, I just don't get where that could come from. So, you know, I'm operating from the standpoint that Kash Patel and Dan Bongino are loyal to Donald Trump, and they're going to want to get to the bottom of this. Mm-hmm. So for anybody, I just think for anybody to make any speculations about anything at this stage of the game, it just doesn't get you anywhere. Let the investigation proceed. And again, I'm going to come back to what I said. The fact that Trump dropped this George Soros bombshell on Fox and Friends today, the way you investigate this is not by fixating on every little element of that. That's going to be done. It's going to be done in Utah. It's going to be done at the federal level and so on. But you've got to swoop in from the top. And who is it that we know? You know, as I mean, I think what Alex said is just extremely important. This U.S.-Russia alliance is the biggest thing that's happened in 100 years from the standpoint of the British Empire. This is what finishes them off. Mm-hmm. And they know it.
Yep.
So they have to stop Trump. And was this a warning to Trump? I have no doubt that it was.
Mm-hmm.
Is it, you know, as Tom was saying, you know, was it a direct hit at a critical aspect of his base? I think that's what its intention was. I think it's going to backfire. I think it's going to completely backfire. Again, as long as people stay focused on the strategic view and not get caught in every little tactical side of it or every, you know, every theory about this, right. We just don't know yet.
Yeah. Okay.
What do people know? They know what they see, you know, on some X feed. What does that mean?
Susan, you're correct. And what I was trying to bring up earlier was that the disinformation is running hot and heavy. And you can see it. It's everywhere. And 48-hour rule was in effect after Charlie got shot. Now we're 48 hours later, and they caught the guy somehow, you know, and be it because he was an idiot and confessed to it to somebody else who turned him in or whatever the story is, it doesn't matter. We're already seeing, you know, the attempted orgy of evidence to try and turn him into to something. Does he have a handle or all that's fine. Another 48 hours, folks, because now we have the shooter. So now we need another 48 hour to 72 hour rule and just take a step back and just wait. What's important now is, again, what Alex brought up, what Susan just brought up, which is very, very important, which is that I've been saying for the last couple of weeks now, certainly since Beijing, and when, you know, people have been asking me, like, well, why is Trump putting secondary sanctions on India? Why is he driving the Indians into the arms of the Russians and the Chinese? I'm like, because he's not trying to drive them into the BRICS. He's trying to drive them away from the Brits. And the way I'm like, and the goal is, it's not BRICS that matters now because Brazil's been taken over. Like, they're putting Bolsonaro in jail, folks, right? No, the BRICS as a thing doesn't matter. What matters is the arc, America, Russia, China. That arc around the Pacific Ocean that Alex and I first talked about, they're reframing the entire world last year, right? And India is a little subscript, because India, sorry, isn't a world power. They LARP as a world power because, you know, they have a lot of population that deep ties to the British. I'm at that point now. I'm like, everybody's trying to meme the Indians into no offense to anybody, but to meme them into positions of power and then use it. And look at the entire H-1B visa situation in the United States. And look at what's happening with the invasion of Canada. They've moved 3.7 million people into Canada this year. Okay? This is a planned thing. And I've been watching this about, you know, with the British schmooze India into a position of power now and trying to build them up into an equivalent of Russia, China, and the United States for years now. And I still don't buy a minute of it. I don't buy it at all. And Modi, for his part, is a similar figure to Erdogan in Turkey, meaning he's an Indian nationalist. So like Erdogan is a Turkish nationalist, and they have their grand dreams of expansion and neocolonialism. You've got the neo-Ottoman in Turkey, you've got whatever, you know, the Indian equivalent is in Mumbai. What's important, or Delhi, what's important here is understand that they may be playing their reindeer games of playing both all sides against each other to get their thing. They're just running their grift. At some point, somebody looks at them and goes, the grift is over, make a choice. And oh, by the way, you're not the top dog here. You don't even get a seat at the table. As a matter of fact, by the time we're done, you don't even get a seat at the kids' table unless you sit down and shut up. That's the way this is playing out. And I know this is like my typical hyper testosterone thing that I do, but you have to understand that I'm doing that because that's the world of power politics that we're returning to. The age of consensus politics is over. So I'm now performatively telling you how it's going down behind the scenes by men of action and men that are of the no bullshit variety. These are mob bosses, and the minor capo is not going to be elevated to the table of the rest of the dons. It's not happening. ARC, ARC, the America, Russia, China. And the British are doing everything imaginable to stop that from happening. And that's why they're moving. That's why they're doing everything they're doing across the Commonwealth. Like, now, like trying we got the guy in Australia, we've got Keir Starmer in the UK. What are they doing? Criminalizing flying your own national flag? Okay, criminalizing speaking out against Islam in any way. Excuse me, I'm trying not to be blunt and horrible and crude in Susan's presence because I'm just trying today. But it's
Susan,
tough.
Show him how it's done.
Yeah. So you understand, but like this is where we are. This is the situation, and everybody better buckle up, Buttercup, because this is not going to play out the way you think it's going to play out.
Yep.
And there's going to be a whole lot of, a whole lot of people putting their genitalia on the table and going, I dare you. And that's what's going on. And we're seeing it from the Russians. And Alex's points about what the Russians said after, the SEO summit. Dmitriev is, again, I agree with you, Alex. He's an important person. He means, with the words that come out of his mouth are far more important than anything that comes out of Peskov's mouth or even Lavrov's mouth at a certain level. Because Lavrov's job is to, deflect and allow diplomacy to happen behind the scenes, right? Dmitriev is a different story whatsoever. It's like listening to Steve Witkoff talk. He's the main negotiator. And so he's an important figure. So, there we go. I don't know where to go from here, but I think that that's I think that the Charlie Kirk assassination, it touches on all of these things. And, now we can move into the context of Donald Trump coming to visit the king.
We are going to come to the UK. We are going to come to the UK.
Because it's all tied into this.
It's all tied in, right? I'm so grateful to all three of you, and I'm really, really fortunate that I get to pick your brains and ask the questions that I want to ask and cover the topics that I want to ask. So thank you all very, very much. This is why I brought you here, right? And also people watching can learn. I want to, talk about Mandelson and the UK and France and Germany and Poland and Ukraine. But before that, Qatar. Sorry, in American English, Qatar. Oh, Qatar. Qatar. In America, I worked in Qatar for 4 years, right? Qatar for the Americans.
Depending on where in America.
Qatar for the English and Qatar, all right, in Arabic. So, Qatar.
I have a lot to say on this, but I've already had the mic.
Okay,
so
Alex, we're going to start. You lead off. Go on, Alex.
Well, Qatar is horrific optics for Trump. And I think that. To a large extent, it's his own damn fault because he fell into the same trap twice in 2 months. So they opened the line with the Iranians. They started discussion negotiations. And then what was it, 13th July, Israelis target Iranian negotiators and kill a whole bunch of them. And now Trump, and I, I give credit to Trump for reaching out to the Iranians and for reaching out to Hamas. So they reach out to them. They have extensive negotiations, and then they say like, "Well, come to Qatar and we'll meet, and we'll continue negotiations." And again, 2 months later, the Israelis come and attempt to assassinate the Hamas negotiations team. Now, a lot of people immediately jumped on the explanation that this was Trump, that he was simply luring them into these negotiations, that he was in cahoots with Benjamin Netanyahu, and that it was done simply to kill them, which doesn't make any sense at all. I mean, it does for Israel because Israel has nothing left to lose. Mm-hmm. So they're just killing everybody. Whoever they can kill, they kill. For the United States, this is horrific because one of the most valuable things that Trump has is credibility. And this was two events that are absolutely toxic to his credibility. And however, while everybody's talking about the Americans, I don't understand why nobody stops to say, cui bono? Obviously, the city of London, bonos, if that's the correct Latin.
It's not, but that's fine.
you know what I mean.
Yeah, no, I know. I just took high school.
So when I heard the news, that was my first hunch, let's say, oh, this is the Brits and the Israelis undermining Trump. This is actually an attack on Trump by killing the Hamas leadership. And then I think it was minutes later, maybe half an hour later, that I found news that there was a British RAF surveillance aircraft that was circling Doha for hours at the time of the attack. Hello? Can it get any more obvious?
Mm.
But it's like nobody's talking about it. And I don't even understand why nobody's talking about it. It's hugely incriminating. But everybody, I think somehow it became fashionable to hate on Trump and to immediately jump on the most the worst possible interpretation of everything on him. You know, so everything bad is Trump. And everything Trump does is done for the worst possible reasons. Mm-hmm. Nothing else can be even contemplated. And then the fact that this British airplane was doing something there, which it is doing over Gaza practically every single day. Mm-hmm. So we know that British surveillance aircraft are flying over Gaza almost every day, and that they are sharing targeting intelligence with the IDF in real time.
Mm-hmm.
So, you know, obviously, the first assumption should be that they were doing that exact thing over Doha at that mm-hmm. time. And so then that angle should be explored, investigated, questioned. No, everybody's running with Trump, and completely ignoring the fact that Israel is the creation of the British Empire, has been since the start.
Yes.
The British fly surveillance and intelligence gathering flights over Gaza through the whole duration of this genocide. Britain is training Israeli commandos in Britain through the whole duration of this genocide. And then another few things, and nobody's questioning the British role. I don't even understand it. And then nobody's asking themselves, why on earth would Trump even do this? Why would he do this? It doesn't make any sense. Like, I mean, even
Alex,
even
he, yeah. This is what I get from my family. One, I get accused of having Trump loyalty syndrome, which is a counterpoint of Trump derangement syndrome. And then it's because he's pro-Zionist. You know, think about what he was doing before. How come he hasn't stopped the slaughter in Gaza? He spent so much trying to stop the slaughter in Ukraine. Good, but he's letting Netanyahu do whatever he's doing, killing all these people.
The US
is sending arms. Hold on a second, Tom. Why the largest US base is in Qatar? Why didn't the Americans do anything to stop this?
I have a theory, and it's not a thesis, it's a theory, and it's a complicated one, and it's one that a lot of people, including myself, don't even want to entertain. And this is going to be downstream of the stuff that we've talked about with the Ember-Erling game, which is that I've said for a while now, go back to Alex, go back to some of the things. Let's go back to 10-7. Let's go back to what you and I talked about the last time we talked to you and I talked about 10-7 on Rich's show about a month ago. And you reminded me that, you know, that 10-7 was orchestrated by the Qatar wing of Hamas backed by the British. And that's who was actually involved in this. Remember that Hamas in this case is not a monolith, right? Just like MAGA isn't an object, folks, right? You know how they've now objectified, they've turned MAGA into a noun, right? Right? They turned it into a noun. And in order to demonize and objectify us to justify their violence, that's what they're doing. Well, in many ways, a lot of what we've seen about, you know, Hamas, to Alex's point, is that Hamas isn't a monolith any more than Iran isn't a monolith, any more than Israel isn't a monolith, any more than the United States or Donald Trump or anybody. None of these things are monoliths. These are organizations that exist with complications and traitors and factions and all the rest of it. So you have to, like, you know, remember who you have to go. What Susan suggested at the beginning, and what Alex has said, cui bono? What's the 40,000-foot strategic view of all of this? Who benefits, and why would one group within that group try to frame another group with these outcomes? So now, if you are Benjamin Netanyahu, and again, none of this is to defend Benjamin Netanyahu. I'm just going to bring this up, and I know it's going to, like, annoy people, but I have to bring it up because we have to at least explore it. Makes me dirty. I want to go take a shower. Ready? Benjamin Netanyahu, the best I can say about Benjamin Netanyahu is that he's an Israeli patriot. Okay? I think that is one aspect of his personality that is fair. And he, like Modi, like Erdogan, like Trump, like Putin, like Xi, like all these men, believe in their country. And if you look at 10/7 as that moment where the British finally decide to burn their asset, which is Israel, to the ground in order to try and start World War III, then Netanyahu's response, from his perspective, is coldly logical. It's disgusting, but coldly logical. And now, ask yourself the bigger question. How do we stop World War III? Well, one of the angles on stopping World War III is to not allow these tensions to rise to the point of explosive activation energy, that they stay simmering below that, that every time that there's pressure relief valves, that as opposed to the whole thing boiling over or blowing the top of the pressure, you know, pressure cooker, you dunk it in ice water every once in a while in order to slow it down. So it builds up and then you slow it down. And so the way I've been thinking about this in recent days is maybe that's what this attack on Qatar looks like in the reframe, which is the following. Trump and Netanyahu are now burning down all of the British's assets, including Qatar, including the Qatar-backed wing of Hamas. Maybe. I don't know. I don't know that it fully tracks, given what, you know, all of the data, but I think there's a thing here where Trump and Netanyahu may actually be in cahoots to burn down all of these assets across the region where the British have their next chaos squad ready to spring up at a moment's notice. And I'm putting Erdogan and his pet Salafist head choppers in Syria on that list as well. Okay? And that's why I believe that Putin told Assad, leave it to the Turks and the Salafists. Let them have it. Because Trump and Netanyahu, and by the virtue of the fact that we're not going to do it, we're getting out of the way, they're going to kill each other all off. Because this is how we stop this thing from exploding in sectarian violence everywhere, by keeping it at all low-level, skirmish-level events, and you bleed out the Turkish army, which is a big friggin' army that needs to be dealt with. And you encourage Erdogan, in the bit of political desperation, as his poll numbers fail, and his currency collapses, and the economy collapses, what does he do? He goes to war. And eventually his army burns itself out. And that, I think, maybe at least some partially explanatory as to why we have that. And of course, what are the British going to do in response to that? They're going to ramp up the anti-Trump, the Donald Trump's Achilles heel, which is his pro-Israeli position at this moment in the zeitgeist. And again, it's not to absolve Israel here, but they've been clearly cast in the role of the ones, okay, we'll just clean everything up and we don't give a shit. We don't care. We don't care what it looks like. We don't care. And now that has blowback on Trump. And this is why I brought up at the beginning here that since the Charlie Kirk murder, I watched the trying to tie this to Israel as quickly as possible and make it all the Jews. And it was all over 4chan. And it was all over X. It was everywhere. And I'm like, I don't buy that. This Charlie Kirk was never, ever really anti in any way. Said anything bad about Israel, but they tried to shape comments out of context and poorly played clips. They did all this stuff. And then you watch the artificial rise of these they call them groypers. And then you watch these guys and you're like, you know for a fact, like, I don't buy for a moment that Nick Fuentes isn't being run by somebody. I don't believe for a second that Ian Carroll is an astroturf, or most of Candace Owens' patter is an astroturf. I'm even beginning to suspect Tucker Carlson on this shit. Like, I don't trust anyone anymore. because this is too pervasive. This is, again, not to say that Israel doesn't deserve some level of opprobrium, but it can be mutated and utilized in a way that is destructive and toxic and to shield the real freaking masters of the freaking chaos. And they become an easy scapegoat, even though they're a really easy scapegoat because they're actually guilty of actual crimes.
Okay.
You know, if I'm Emperor Palpatine, I'm like, yeah, that works. Go with that plan.
Okay.
Like, I hate to even bring it up because I know what it sounds like, but like, guys.
Well, you cycle back to Trump's first administration and the Abraham Accords, and you read some of the firsthand reports of who basically sabotaged them. He says it's Netanyahu.
Right.
I mean, he said it was Netanyahu who he had mm-hmm. the most trouble actually negotiating with. I'm not going to characterize Netanyahu one way or another. I think the factor that the British play the most in this region is the religious fundamentalism they've created on both sides.
Mm-hmm.
You know, Tom talks about, you know, Netanyahu as an Israeli nationalist, you know, up to a point. Yeah, but let's not leave out the fact that you have the, you know, the ultra fanatic Zionist faction, the settlers movement and so on. Whatever Netanyahu is, he's also dealing with that. How yes. sympathetic he is to it, you know, I'm going to leave to somebody else to determine. So you've got that factor, which is totally created by the British. And then you've got the entirety of Muslim fundamentalism, which is totally created by the British, going back decades and decades and decades to the Muslim Brotherhood. So if you look at it, from the standpoint of Trump's approach was, we're not going to solve it at that level. You know, you're going to end up fighting over inches again, as we did, you know, after previous attempts at settling it. You have to break the paradigm. You have to break the paradigm by bringing in a new concept of shared economic development, especially for the younger leaders in the region, which is what he was very much orienting to in terms of Saudi Arabia and some of these other countries, people who had not spent the last 40 years of their lives entangled in this geopolitical hotspot. And I think he's still trying to do that,
mm-hmm.
To essentially break the matrix that everybody is in. And once you're in religious warfare, as my friend Barbara Boyd keeps saying, if you think you're going to solve it at that level, you're crazy, because one side is saying, my God is telling me to do this. And the other side is saying, my God is telling me to do that. Well, I'm sorry, you don't negotiate your way out of that. You create a different paradigm of shared economic development. I think that's what Trump is trying to do. And that's why he's working with Qatar. That's why he's working with the UAE. That's why he's working with the Saudis. Remember, first trip he made in his first term, the first foreign trip, was to Saudi Arabia.
Yes.
And what he said to them is, cut your ties to Islamic fundamentalism. And from that point on, we did not see major Islamic fundamentalist attacks, major, especially against the United States or Western nations. Because you knew first you had to dry up the terrorism on that side of it. Then you had to come in and try and break the paradigm. So the trip he took recently to the Mideast was, again, precisely from that standpoint and making the point, I know we're not going to solve this from the standpoint of the religious hatreds which have been inflamed, he doesn't say, by the British. We all know that. But you have to bring in a different paradigm. And I think that's what the British are continually trying to disrupt. I think what happened in terms of both of these attacks, Iran and Doha, by the Israelis, might give some of the people who think that Trump is controlled by Netanyahu or whatever pause to think maybe that's not the case. If indeed, you know, this is a continued attempt to sabotage what he is trying to do, which is to create a completely different paradigm. Go back to the Camp David Accords. Why did they fail? I mean, outside of the fact that a crazy Zionist killed Yitzhak Rabin somewhere down the road, they failed because you did not get economic development. There were no shovels in the ground. In fact, they put the development for the West Bank and Gaza under the World Bank. So, you know, immediately it just came to a screeching halt. And it was then very easy to disrupt with the assassination of Yitzhak Rabin. If you don't have massive economic development to break people out of this, you know, this world of perpetual religious warfare that the British have created, you're not going to solve it. And from where I'm sitting, the only one who's trying to do that is Trump. Is he succeeding? You know, does he have partners? Is it getting sabotaged? But I think that's what he's trying to do.
Okay, Susan. Before he got, no, I completely get the importance of economic development and how that's the only thing that's going to stop the hatred, the religious fueled hatred that the British have ginned up, and not forgetting the Christian Zionists. So you go, but before he was inaugurated, he had Witkoff fly over, meet Netanyahu on the Saturday on the Shabbat, and have Netanyahu sign a peace agreement. Why isn't he doing anything like that now? And neither of you have answered the question about how come the American Air Force base in Qatar didn't stop or do anything to protect Doha.
I told you why. Because the goal here was to send the message to Qatar, your bullshit's over. You're the center of the Muslim Brotherhood. You're the center of British property in the Middle East. And we just told you that's enough.
Okay, so just so I'm really clear. So the
That's my argument, Rich. I don't know if it's true or not. I'm only making it.
Sure. Just so I'm really clear on the argument that you're making, and you're not saying this is the case, but as a possibility, as a possible interpretation.
Because it fits with what you just asked, right? Why didn't we try to stop this?
Because
why?
The Americans had the orders not to do that.
Take the temperature down, you have to start knocking out, look, again, mob boss hits. Okay, that's kind of my thing here. Like this is getting rid of Sonny Corleone. Like, you know what I mean?
That absolutely fits.
If we look at it, look from that perspective, sometimes you have to do something that makes no damn sense in order to be able to get to somewhere else you want to go. Alex, you've been very patient, very quiet. I want to hear what you have to say about any and all of this, because I know your perspective on this is different than both of ours, and I really do welcome you bringing it to the table. So,
well, not necessarily. I mean, my perspective is not necessarily all that different, but before I get into any of that, I have to go back to Netanyahu being a Jewish patriot. I listened to Netanyahu speak at the World Economic Forum about how he was going to turn Israel into the largest open-air experiment for Pfizer. So, you know, using your people as guinea pigs for an experimental product is not exactly my definition of patriotism. Okay, now, something Susan said I think is very important. It came through in passing, but I think I want to underscore it and go back to it because it is very true, and people don't really realize this, is that this jihadi Islam and this extremist, fanatical Jewish factions are all products of British foreign policy. They've all been incubated by British foreign policy. The Brits have cultivated Wahhabis and Wahhabi sect of Islam since the 18th century. Since the 19th century, since the 1800s, because at some point they decided they needed to take down Germany. And Germany was having good relations with the Ottoman Empire, and they were building the Berlin to Baghdad railway across territories controlled by the Ottoman Empire. So the Brits decided, okay, so we have to break the Germans, and to do that, we need to break up the Ottoman Empire. And of course, Brits never fight their own wars. They always get somebody else to fight it for them. So they started cultivating these Wahhabi sects out of Saudi Arabia, and they started to rail them up against the Ottomans, and they even made deals with them. Okay, you help us take down the Ottomans, and then we're gonna help you create a united Arabia, you know, because this is what they wanted. Of course, the Brits had no intention of honoring their word. So they didn't deliver on their promise, even though the Arabs did deliver on that promise and suffered hundreds of thousands of dead. Anyhow, the Brits continued and are continuing to this day to cultivate these jihadis. Their Islam has barely anything to do with the real Islam. It's hard to even believe, you know, like... A Muslim cannot kill a non-combatant. These people just shoot at other Muslims because they're not their sect, right? They'll in Syria, they ask you, are you an Alawite? Yeah, I'm an Alawite. Boom, they just shoot them dead. Farmers, you know, normal people, women, children, it doesn't matter. But they are very useful to the British, who have no army. They have no army of any consequence to help them reach their ends in economic policy, in foreign policy, and to help them realize their agenda. And so here's I'll give you a quote from an expert Orientalist who has researched into this. And so this is what she says. This is her words. UK is trying to take helm of world domination from the United States. One of their tools is the control of virtually all radical Islamist movements in the world through secret intelligence assets like the Turkish deep state, Pakistan, and others. And then, you know, same thing about the Jews in Israel, because again, Israel was the creation of the British Empire, and this was the brainchild of the Round Table Group, Alfred Milner's Round Table Group, and they spoke out about this, and they said, well, you know, if Britain is to remain a maritime empire, we need to cede that region, meaning, you know, the Palestine, we need to cede that region with a particularly patriotic stock. Particularly patriotic means pretty much religious fanatics. So, and this was spoken in the 1920s. So a few years after the Balfour Declaration, but way, way, way before the actual creation of Israel. And then, now that they're losing in Ukraine, guess what they're doing, apparently? And these are reports from Colonel Douglas McGregor, but he said that in Ukraine, there's an appearance of new Jewish communities where there's some kind of a private police there, and only Jews are allowed to go there in the south of Ukraine, in the region of Odessa. So some of these villages that have been completely abandoned, or there's barely any people still living there, apparently Jewish people are coming there. So there, it seems that they're repeating the 20th century, creating a new beachhead and seeding it with a particularly patriotic stock again. And so if these reports are true, it means that what they've done in Palestine with Israel, creation of Israel, they're now trying to replicate in Ukraine, in the south of Ukraine, around Odessa, in order to again have a beachhead populated with religious fanatics.
Thank you, Alex. Thank you. And you mentioned, I think, in a previous video, how they're also doing that with Cyprus, another divided.
Correct.
Bringing them in there, right? And I've learned more about that. And just the thing about the
but you know, the point is, you realize who bonos again from seeding any particular region with particularly patriotic stock, which means they don't care about the Jews. They're using them as cannon fodders,
yes,
for their own ends, which, yes, are colonialism, imperialism, domination, permanent warfare, destruction, and so on and so forth.
And again, Alex, this dovetails kind of what I was trying to get at. And yes, which is that they don't care about anybody. These are all rapid. I've used the phrase many times, and I'm going to use it again. Rapidly depreciating asset. The American support for Israel, as unbounded, is over. So you've got to use that in some other way. And if it turns that you can, at the end, you can turn around and then turn Americans against Israel and then use that for your advantage, well, of course you would.
Yeah.
And that's what I'm getting at here. And that's what Alex just illuminated. And they'll do the same thing to the Salafist head choppers. They'll do the same thing to the Muslim Brotherhood. They'll do the same thing to all of them. So the question then becomes, if someone sees that game, then you ask yourself the question, okay, the interesting, while you were talking, Alex, this just happened to get a note from Ian Burlingame about, he just posted on Twitter about what he believes, that like that Trump and Putin agreed 100% in Alaska to stop World War III, and that Putin gave Trump some kind of intelligence that has led to him bombing the fast boats coming out of Venezuela, to the bombing in Doha, and all these other things. That these these little events need to be done, even if they're quote unquote extra, you know, extrajudicial or whatever you want to call them, extrajudicial killings or whatever. This is just shit you have to get done to start cleaning up the mess and start sending the right message to the right people. And, you know, again, if we think back to where we were in June, and then how the quote unquote 12-day war to Israel and Iran ended, in the short term, it looked bad for Trump. In the long term, it actually works out because Trump has now been able to take all of that stuff off the table. The Israelis don't have any reason to attack Iran unless Iran gets stupid and starts, you know, ginning up the fact that, oh, we're building nuclear weapons again. And then you got to ask yourself, well, why would you do that when you already had an out? When Donald Trump gave you the out, why are you doing that again?
Yep. Okay.
And this is the kind of, this is why we have to like distrust everything we see from everyone, but realize that the major powers, Russia, China, the United States, are the ones at a certain level, they keep acting very consistently to attempt to disrupt all the chaos. And so I find it really fascinating that all of this is happening and then they try to float out this, you know, this thing about the drones over Poland. Which, sadly, the Russians kind of cop to, at least some of it, right? Because they have to. Like, we know that Poland is an active agent in this war in Ukraine. But then Trump turns around on one hand and puts secondary sanctions on people for selling Russia oil, and then lifts sanctions against Belarus's airlines. Like, what's more important? Like, you know, I'm sorry, and I know that you have, and then the typical British assets, Sikorsky and the rest of them, all come out of the woodwork to try and gin up, no, we have to go to war with Russia. And I'm like, oh, please.
Yes.
Like, this is like right after, you know.
When it comes to Ukraine and Poland, right? And something you reminded me of that I've often said, and I think I needed to make a note to go and visit some more Scorsese gangster movies. Because using that as a model of interpretation, it just really, really fits because you've got these big, big bosses, mob bosses, and they got to do all these other actions in order to divide up this turf and get rid of these other gangsters and mob bosses or whatever, right?
And their punishment. And it's funny, I did a podcast with Dexter White and Matt Arrett the other day. I don't know if you guys had a chance to listen to it or not, but Matt like brought great receipts on the role of the drug trade and the mob protection that the British have afforded various ethnic mob groups, from the Albanians to Russians to Venezuelans to Colombians to this ones, all of them, Canadian, all of them, Chinese triads and all of it. And that so much of it runs through Canada. Right. And so, you know, when Matt was talking about that stuff, it was an angle on Canada I had never really, well, neither Dexter nor I had actually ever, you know, even contemplated, right? So it was a great moment of like, oh, wow, we just get to sit back and let Matt Arrett like just give us all the goods on this. And it was great. So it's just, and we're only, I think, beginning to really scratch the surface of that model, unless, you know, Susan or Alex knows more about this stuff than I do. And I get to sit back and go.
Well, I want to go to Britain, the head of the snake, right? And
do Wait, just before you do, Rich, I just wanted to add something else. Just a few days ago, J.D. Vance, and this was just after the Russian drones, he went on OAN Network with Matt Gaetz,
mm-hmm.
and J.D. Vance said, like, we see no reason to continue to hold sanctions against Russia.
He said that. I missed that.
Yes, he said that. And so I think that that's another thing that's coming. And I think that as soon as they get rid of Russia sanction, the Russians are probably going to order Europeans to transfer their frozen funds to the United States. And the Europeans are going to bitch and complain and moan and cry and beg. And Trump is going to say, you better do this or else. And then the Europeans are just going to have the worst day ever.
Alex, so I mean, when we were in Calgary together, for Sean Newman's conference, at the beginning of the day, before the festivities started that morning, a guy, one of my patrons, had flown in from Houston. He had just come from Singapore. He's in the oil industry. And he came up to Ryan and said to me, look, I took a red eye up here to tell you because I didn't want to put it out over. And like, they're targeting July 1st. To try and start ending Russian sanctions. I don't know if they're going to get there or not, but the scuttlebutt is that it's July 1st. And then we had some of those sanctions lifted, especially on civilian nuclear programs. Like a lot of the banks were unsanctioned so that they could do civilian nuclear development around the world. That happened actually the weekend before July 1st. So I get some receipts on that. Interestingly enough, when we were in, I can say this now because it's September, but when we had dinner before we left Calgary with Martin Armstrong, I asked Marty, I told Marty, I heard this. And he said, yeah, I've heard the same thing. So like behind the scenes, there's a lot of stuff happening that we don't see and that don't get reported in the headlines. And, you know, I've talked about it privately with my patrons, but I haven't talked about it publicly really. It's just to remind everybody that, you know, and I don't take every bit of information that I get, you know, as gospel truth, folks. I say, well, thank you very much. And then I put it in the hopper and I put it up on the board and I see if it comes true or not. Mm-hmm. But every once in a while you get, you know, when you see these things occur, you're like, oh, there was the receipt on that one. There was the, you know, and so it's just to underscore the point that we've all made so far today that there's serious, real, honest to God negotiations going on between Russia and the United States. And that's part of the reason why the battlefield is so murky right now. Because yeah. It's being accelerated to a fever pitch to try and stop this from happening. So I think it's time to talk about Trump's visit to the king.
Well, not yet, because I think the natural flow of the conversation, we will go and visit the head of the snake. But the point that you made just now, Tom, that it's like they're going to get more and more desperate because they're losing, and they'll get more and more frantic and they'll throw more shit at it in order to prevent this union between the United States and Russia and China, because otherwise then Europe and the UK are screwed. So let's stick with that, and then we can go, including Poland and Belarus, because I noticed how they were dropping the sanctions against Belarus and looking at opening up an embassy in Minsk at the same time as several NATO nations are doing military drills on the border of Belarus.
Of course.
Yeah. So, Susan, over to you.
Well, I mean,
let's
we
visit
all know.
Eastern Europe.
Europe is going crazy. So, you know, and I mean, they're obviously the front line of the drive to keep the war going, to escalate the war and so on. No, I don't have a whole lot to add in terms of this. I mean, I think the important thing is, and I didn't know about the lifting of some of these sanctions, but this very much fits into this picture, you know, that to use a metaphor, which is perhaps obvious, the bear in the room. I mean, the bear in the room is the Russian-U.S. alliance, you know, which is going on behind the scenes. Now, Trump has to deal, you know, with a layer of his own still Republican Party, which is still nuts on these questions. I had a bit of a back and forth earlier this week with a political figure here in Michigan, you know, who can't get over his neocon, you know, orientation. But I did stop and he says, well, but Russia's doing this and Russians are doing that. And I said, well, I'm much more concerned about what MI6 and MI5 are doing and how they tried to throw Trump out. And he goes, you know, I mean, that wasn't really in his worldview. But I think that's just the determining characteristic. And it's, I mean, the Poland thing is, I mean, how obvious can it get? And of course, Trump comes out and says, well, I'm not really sure it is the Russians, you know, and Tusk goes crazy and the rest of them and so on and so forth. But I think the overall dynamic is precisely what we've been discussing. And unless people recognize that that's where the chessboard is, you know, it's not down here on a game of checkers. That's where the chessboard is. It's, you know, that's how this thing is playing itself out. And it does make them desperate. And that does get back to an increase in what we call irregular warfare here in the United States, which is what the assassination of Charlie Kirk was. And the attempt to then use that to create a pre-Civil War situation. I don't think that's going to happen here. Right. But I think that is the guiding dynamic.
Yeah. Okay. Well, if you take it over to the head of the snake, to the UK, and I think what I'm seeing is the City of London, the imperialist strategy playing out as they're stoking a religious war, a race war between English people and Muslims. And for people who don't know, you know, I'm Muslim. My brother's married to a Jewish woman. My wife is Scottish Christian. I wasn't born here. I'm an immigrant, came here when I was five. But and I'm concerned the way that it's playing out. You know, one of the things that the Labour government are looking at doing is they want to make it a criminal offence for, like, Islamophobia, to make that a criminal offence. So you can't criticise Islam. They don't care about Muslims because they're supporting Israel killing them in the Middle East. No, it's just a strategy in order to stoke hostility between Muslims and migrants, many of whom won't be Muslim, but most of them will be, and indigenous people, white, English,
Welsh, Scottish, Christian people, because it's now people are being penalized for pulling down for putting up English flags. And for me, the irony is, it used to be in the late 70s, you know, because I grew up during the days of the National Front doing their demonstrations and stuff, right, that the English flag really did represent racism. Now I see an English flag and I'm like, oh God, come on, please, 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 right? But the important thing is that for us to divide, to unite, and then see that actually we are being shaken like ants, the Muslim ants and the English ants, and the British imperialists are the ones who are doing the shaking so that they can continue to impoverish us and steal our wealth and our resources. And then Trump is coming to the UK. And it's next week, isn't it?
Mm-hmm.
So, Susan, do you want to start off with that? And who is?
Well, all I can say is I am not going to try and predict what Donald Trump is going to do when he comes next week. I will say that, you know, the fact that the ambassador, Peter Mandelson, was knocked out just last week, and I might say less than 24 hours after I made his role in the Epstein files the focus of my Wednesday update. So I'm gonna take a little bit of credit for that. You know, so you obviously have a, I mean, so think about the timing. Is, you know, was this a carefully thought out plan to release the Epstein files, and everybody is all focused on the birthday book and Trump's signature and this, that, and the other thing, and boom, what does it do? It knocks out the British ambassador 1 week before Trump goes for his state visit. So I'm not going to say any more than that, because Trump is completely unpredictable, and many times what you see is not what you get, right? You know, people say, oh, he goes, he likes the Queen. Well, of course, the last time he walked in front of the Queen, we all remember that. You know, is he going to make nice with King Charles? Probably. I don't know. But again, what you see is not what you get. And I don't know what you're going to get.
Alex?
Well, I agree with Susan that Trump is completely unpredictable. The reason why I'm worried about him going there is I hope that he's bringing his food and his chef and and his portable toilet and all of these things. Because I, you know, didn't somebody publish a booklet about a booklet called, titled, "It's the British Who Murder Our Presidents." That's like this great Promethean action organization. So
I've heard about them, Promethean Action. I think they're really, really good and worth subscribing.
I hope that Trump is aware of this, and I hope that his security services made some, you know, arrangements for to make sure that he comes back and without any, you know, injections or anything else from which he might drop dead. But anyway, I have to add this, which is not directly related to his visit to the United Kingdom, but, you know, he had this 3-hour dinner with Bill Gates. And then he had this dinner where he invited all these other scumbags all around him,
including Tony Blair.
And then there was,
and then a few days later, Mandelson is exposed.
And Tony Blair.
Behind Mandelson.
And I think, again, you know, all the Trump hating people out there immediately jump on it. Oh, look, he's in cahoots with Bill Gates. Oh, look, he's in cahoots with Mark Zuckerberg and all these people. I don't really think so. Do you? I mean, you know, just because Don Corleone invites you for dinner and sits with you for 3 hours and says something doesn't mean that Don Corleone is your friend, right?
Right.
It might be something similar to what Vladimir Putin did when he invited oligarchs in 2003 or 2002. I forget when it was. Yeah. And said, these are the new rules. This is how we're doing things. And, you know, like if people remember in 2017, I think, or 16, Bill Gates went to see Trump, and then he gave that interview. And Bill Gates was all full of himself. He was all smug how he set this idiot Trump straight, because Trump wanted to do this and this. And he had this person, Robert F. Kennedy Jr., you know, he pretended like he didn't know the name, like he didn't know who this was, to look into the safety of vaccines. And I told them, no, don't do that. That would be bad. Well, do you see Bill Gates' body language now? He's really humble. he's really not cocky and smug like he was 8 years ago. So I don't think that all these meetings are, hey, you know, we're all friends and let's rip everybody off together. And so I think that his visit to the UK and the King could probably be the same thing, to say, hey, you know, our special relationship is going to change. Set aside the Vaseline. Sorry. It's going to be different.
It's going to be different. Vassal.
I hear the part of Tom Longo will be played by Alex Craner. That is so someone asked me earlier, I brought up the King the other day, and somebody asked me on Twitter, why is he going into the den of the enemy? I said, to negotiate terms of surrender, or to hand them terms of surrender.
Maybe.
Like, again, to note, I've been calling every meeting that Trump has with a head of state or somebody else in Mar-a-Lago as a struggle session. Like, commies like to, you know, put the person up on there and make them publicly renounce their views and break them down publicly through psychological struggle sessions. Well, I can tell you that every meeting that Trump has had so far this year at the White House has been some form of struggle session, where he got the EU leaders to stand there in a public meeting before they went to actually negotiate, and he forced them all to say a few words for peace, like they were all running for Miss America. Like, I was talking about this the other day. Like, it's like that scene in Miss Congeniality when she's standing up. Have you ever seen those with Sandy Bullock? She's standing up there and she's the cop posing as the beauty queen, beauty pageant contestant. And she's like, what do you want to see in the world? What her name is? And she's like, Gracie. And he's like, stiffer sentences for repeat offenders. And world peace, right? Because they all said world peace. That was the standard answer. Well, that's what he forced them to do. At the White House, and then he threw out Ursula von der Leyen out saying, you're not a head of state, get out of here. And then they tried to like schmooze him in the private meeting. And he's like, no, but I'm getting Vlad on the phone. Let's settle this shit now, not in 2 months. And Frederick Merz is like, you know, like drooling like the idiot that he is. Like, it's so obvious what he's doing to these people. I watched that meeting between Zuckerberg and Gates. I watched and of course he films it all and then puts it on his feed, and they can't hide. And so they have to mouth the words. And that's how you beat them. You humiliate them. You force them to let everybody see them for who they actually are. And they go, oh, well, they said nice things here. Yeah, but we know you're scumbags. We know. So now what? So you make them say they want peace, and then they go home and scheme for war. And then that allows Trump to then say, look, I got them together. We were supposed to negotiate this out. I'm the good guy here. They're the bad guy. I can walk away from them. I can wash my hands of all of this. Because remember, the thing that's lost, and I know Susan understands this because she's an American, but you know, think about your own political situations at home, your domestic political situations, how you have to move your electorate, and how you have to move the traitorous Congress that you're dealing with, who respond to and will use any weakness on Trump's part to then block everything that he wants to do. Right. So he has to tread very, very carefully and very, very lightly through all of these issues and move the normie political space in his direction so that they can't betray him in Congress. And then he shows up with the manila envelopes and says, yeah, you work for me now. Oh, and by the way, this happened and the Supreme Court thing happened. And so, oh, by the way, I control the Epstein files and sorry. And so the only one left to really bring down here, the only ones left are Blumenthal and Lindsey Graham. Notice how they were out yesterday playing their game of adding Russia to the terrorist watch list. Always Blumenthal and Graham. They are the two worst members of the Senate. So, and of course,
well, to Alex's point, maybe Trump should invite one of him as his food taster.
Yeah. I so like the way she thinks. You know, like I want to play Dune with Susan. Okay. So that's good. That's very, very good. So, as long as J.D. Vance doesn't go to England, we're good, because he's just, you know, because he's clearly being groomed to be Trump's replacement. But I think that, you know, the big telling will be, is it going to happen in fucking Palace, or is it going to happen at Trump's castle in Scotland? Would be hilarious. To watch like the King get off of the of Marine One, and then have like Keir Starmer didn't have to walk up and meet Trump at his castle. Like, oh, by the way, I'm in charge.
Mine's bigger than yours.
If I were Trump, that's what I would do. But he's too polite. He's actually too polite for that. But you know, it is what it is.
It's a state visit. It will be in London at all the British official venues.
But just going back to, and any of you can comment on this, Trump's meeting with Blair, and then Mandelson gets exposed. I mean, I think we all knew about Mandelson's sordid relationship with Epstein, but it comes out in such a way that he's gone. He's got to be gone.
Yeah.
So then, and then this is just before, like you mentioned earlier, before his state visit. So then, and then there's all the stuff that Keir Starmer is doing. Keir Stasi, Keir Starling, whatever his name is, like the barefaced lying, standing.
Keir Starling is what I like.
Standing next to Trump saying, no, 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 we have a rich tradition of free speech in the UK.
Yeah, which you're shitting all over.
Yeah. Yeah, which Trump will know because there was a congressional hearing on it, and JD mm-hmm. Vance has done stuff on this. He completely, mm-hmm. completely knows. So I suppose we'll have to wait for the next time we get together.
well, the one thing I want to note about the Mandelson thing.
People can also follow you independently, each of you, and go to the links for Alex and Susan and Tom. Go on, Tom.
Well, I was going to say this is for Alex. Alex, did you notice that after Mandelson was removed, that the first thing they floated was they wanted to put Sir Richard Moore.
Yes. No, you're joking. No, I didn't say that.
James.
Yes, and for people who don't know, he's a former head. He's still
head of MI6. The guy who's literally behind all of Russiagate, and everything else has been going on. Like Alex has receipts on. I know his name because Alex knows. Because Alex brings him up every second time we're on a podcast together. So yeah. Alex, they want to install him as ambassador to the United States. What, like? Like Trump doesn't know who this guy is,
right?
Of course, he does.
Seriously, yeah. Or is this another one of keep my enemies really freaking close? You don't get this to hang out over in England anymore. You have to come over here and you have to hang out, and we're just going to stick you in a hotel on the ass under Washington D.C. and you get to stay there, and you're not allowed out, and you can only order DoorDash from 2-star restaurants and lower. No, you only get to eat American food.
Yeah, right.
That would be the thing. Only McDonald's. You only get McDonald's and Diet Coke. That's it. That's what I would do.
And decaf coffee.
decaf coffee.
I think that's very, very nice of you. I would have them eat Bill Gates' artificial meat and crickets.
Ooh.
There you go.
It's the whole make a British Nazi like eat fake American. Because look, it's arguable, honestly, as to whether fake meat and bugs are worse for you than the average meal at McDonald's. So, yeah.
Okay.
I'm going to go have steak when this is over.
Lucky you, Tom. Okay, so then let's hop over. Actually, before we do, there's the perilous state of the British economy. And then we can, if you any of you want to
come to France?
And then France. We can go to France.
You guys go. I know how France was going to go. It was obvious, but you guys go.
Alex?
I'm not up to date on anything recent about the British economy.
Okay, all right, that's fine.
It does suck.
Keir Starling is destroying it. Do you want to comment on France? Do you want to start with France, Alex?
Well, I think that France is possibly on the verge of a social uprising, if not civil war. It remains to be seen because, you know, at this... The people are not allowed to change the government and force a course correction of their country by legitimate democratic means, mm-hmm. which means that they're going to be left with only violent means. And this is being forced on them because Macron is not allowing them to choose their own, to choose the next government. They're using lawfare against the most popular candidates. And Macron is toying with the idea of just staying in power and ruling by decree. Well, I know that, you know, the French military is not thrilled with it. The French have this gendarme organization, which is, gendarmes are something like halfway between military and police in France. And they have this organization of their veterans. And they're not joking around with this with Macron. I know that Macron has received at least one, but I think more than one, two letters from the military and from the gendarmes saying that we're going to take you out. We're going to stage a coup. Be very careful. And so something's going to blow up. But you know, this is one of those things where you can't predict what's going to happen and when. You know, there might be a triggering event. or the government might try to front run it by creating social uprising, you know, riots themselves, in order to then go and crack down and just say, okay. And then, you know, Ursula von der Leyen said that there's another health emergency coming up. We're already in it or on the verge.
Yeah.
And so we don't know what she didn't explain. It's just it's going to be a surprise.
Surprise pandemic. Yeah.
But, you know, they might then decide we're going to do climate lockdowns or a new virus lockdown or whatever, and everybody has to stay home. But I think that this time around, people are not going to believe any of it, and they're not going to comply. And so things could get really, really, really interesting during this year. But, who could predict what happens?
Well, I was going to say, Alex, this is one of the reasons why I wanted you to comment on France, because you're probably following me a little bit. I was going to ask that very question. What's the situation with the French military? Because clearly the only way that Macron has lost civilian legitimacy as president. So the only reason he would stay in power at this point is that the French military is still willing to back him for whatever, you know, misguided reason they want. But if they're already at the point of allowing, of saying that they're sending him sternly worded letters, dude, it's time for you to go. Like, you know, when the day comes and he tries to call in, you know, hey, we need to put all this down, and they don't show up, that's when, you know, I'm finally going to get paid on my long on guillotines. And that's fine. I mean, you know, I have open ended. I just bought open ended shares. I ain't playing Theta games on my options on being long guillotines. So, yeah, I mean, I think it's pretty clear at this point. You're looking at someone who has almost zero popular support or civilian support. He has no legitimacy, and yet he's going to play. He's not just playing lawfare against Marine Le Pen. He's playing lawfare, for all intents and purposes, against the French people.
Yeah, yeah.
Okay. And Stalin in the UK is doing the same thing. He has no legitimacy. And, you know, now let's look at the situation all around Europe. And I've been watching the capital flows carefully, and watching the changes that are happening within the bond markets and the bond spreads. They're collapsing very, very quickly. American, German bond spreads are down to 10 years, down to 1.35 as we close into the end of the month. Like, dude, anything below 1.6 is catastrophic for Christine Lagarde. And that's happening against the German bond, a German 10-year German bond trading at 2.7%, which is at the upper end of the range that she's been trying to defend for literally 4 years. And, you know, the one thing we haven't talked about in all of this is how the capital markets are, how they're responding to the changes that they're perceiving. But it's all very, very clear, especially given that my boy Jerome Powell got rid of the 2% inflation target the other day, which was one of the most horrendous things that that's a rollback of the Federal Reserve. Like, the 2% inflation target was agreed upon by the globalists during the 2000s to then usher in the turbo inflation and QE and zero bound interest rates and negative interest rates and nerve reserve and all that stuff. That was the justification for it. All old monetary policy restrictions went out the window if we started doing inflation targeting. Now, all the people who hate Powell think that he's going to allow inflation. Yeah, that means that he's going to let inflation run hot and he's going to print a whole bunch of money. No, what he's saying is now going to, you know, I can use monetary policy to support the labor market. But because the world is changing and because we're funding the United States differently than we have, we're in transition to a different system, we're not going to necessarily have the same things happening. We're going to have headline inflation in the United States because of these AI data centers, you know, sucking up all this freaking power, and we can't build power plants fast enough and in the right places in order to deal with it. That's a big problem. And all of these Spurg boy, you know, tech bros who think they're going to like put us all in their digital prisons. I got news for you. If the price of electricity in the United States spikes to 25, 28 cents a kilowatt hour, they're all going to be marched through the streets, and I'm going to be Texas hedged being long guillotines, which is double long, by the way, for those of you who don't speak financial geek, because, you know, the Sam Altmans of the world, they're all going to get killed too. Like, this is not going to fly, but this is what they're planning for us. That's another one of their back doors to civil unrest. Okay. And then they get to play the headline game. Donald Trump's got inflation and all this stuff while Powell's doing the right thing, which is right now needing to cut rates to stimulate the reorganization and the recapitalization of the middle class. It has to start now. And it has to start with a cutting of interest rates for about 125 basis points over the course of the next 6 months. And we're running into that same cross current with the spiking, because I looked at the CPI data the other day, the spiking electricity prices in the United States up over 13% year over year. Pipe natural gas is up over almost 9% year over year, but gasoline prices were down 6.6%. And I've been tracking, you know, the inflation as a 4-month rolling, the CPI as a 4-month rolling average versus the month-end price of gasoline futures. And they've been in lockstep for 3 years now as a kind of commodity cost push inflation environment where gasoline and the CPI go up and down together directionally, not necessarily in terms of volume or in terms of amplitude, but certainly in terms of direction, either up or down. And so we just had a break point where gasoline prices last month went down, but inflation went up. And that's the data point. It's not a trend, but it could be the beginning of a trend, because inside the data is the shift away from gasoline being the determiner of inflation and moving into electricity being the cause of inflation. And that has everything to do with the rise of, you know, the cost of running these data centers and the strain that's being put on the grid. And I think that strain is being put on the grid on purpose, for no good fucking reason than to assert eventually civil unrest through, you know, the 110 outlet in your home, the 3-prong outlet in your homes. So watch that space very, very carefully as another vector of the hybrid warfare that the color revolution warfare script that they're running, which is why Donald Trump needs to put fucking George Soros in jail. Yeah. Especially after they tried to kill Rudy Giuliani.
You were doing Mr. so Rico good. Himself. You were doing so good until just now. And
oh, yeah. Not one F-bomb all day, right? Not one F-bomb. 90 minutes. I did good. Fuck them. Or as they joke them if they can't take a fuck, right? You know, that's like, you know, hold on. All right, guys. That's my spiel for the day.
Susan, you want to comment on that?
I'll just make the point, you know, I think the administration is aware of it. Chris Wright, the energy secretary, gave a really powerful speech earlier this week to the All In conference, and he made. I mean, they know this. They know they've got to get more energy dense energy on the grid. I mean, and he was very, very clear. I mean, he schooled people. You know, it's only energy dense energy, nuclear, natural gas, fossil fuels, which are going to address this, and that they're going to try and accelerate, you know, the ability to do this. He made a very interesting point in that speech, because he actually it shows you that there are elements of this administration who do get the big picture. He said the same people who push climate change, you know, as a way of throttling. Well, he made the point. There's 2 billion people on this planet who still cook with wood. And that creates 2 to 3 million preventable deaths, you know, because of what that actually means. And he lays that, of course, right at the lap of the whole green fascist agenda and so on. And then he said the people who push climate change are the same people who deny capital to the developing world for them to develop. In other words, they understand that these are not separate issues. You've got the green lunacy over here and you have the central banks over here. This is all of a one of British imperial policy to use central banks, or in the case of green fascism, ideology, to hold people back, to prevent their ability to develop. And I just come back to what I said at the beginning in terms of what Trump said today on Fox and Friends. We're going to unify the country by succeeding. But what does succeeding mean? Succeeding means you unleash the economic power of our nation. You free us from central banking, from insane ideologies, and so on. You unleash the productive power of our nation. Do it in concert with Russia and China and so on. This is what the British are afraid of. So, you know, I'm sure they've got, again, they've got 5, 6, 7 scenarios. But if Trump is allowed to succeed in doing this, and that means more Americans have to understand what he's doing and back him fully, I think we can outflank all of these games.
Yes. And what they should, one of the things that they should do, everybody should do, is follow Promethean Action on all their channels to stay informed. You know, one of the things that strikes me is how meticulous each of you is in terms of the research that you do and then what you bring in order to educate and inform others. So thank you very much. Okay, is there anything else any of you want to cover or talk about that we haven't covered?
Well, I just want to toss in a question, a rhetorical question, that, you know, we've had for decades, for centuries, we had these globalists routinely assassinate people to move them off the scene. And I was always kind of wondering, you know, then the reaction is always like, oh, damn, you know, they killed JFK. Oh, damn, they killed Abraham Lincoln. Oh, damn, they killed Alfred Herrhausen. Oh, they killed that Charlie Kirk. How come nobody ever pops their people? I mean, I don't know. Is that happening? Or I was just wondering about that, because, you know, you keep doing things if you get away with it and you profit from it. People who killed JFK went scot-free, and by killing JFK, they became a lot more powerful than they were before they killed him. I think that at some point, they have to face consequences, right?
Sure. And the Ceausescu's face consequences. That's what came to mind. But we're not the psychopaths.
And also, I mean, you have to kill the ideology. I mean, they kill people because they see leaders who represent a powerful idea. You know, Abraham Lincoln understood the American system. McKinley understood the American system. Kennedy in sort of instinctually understood it. Most of the population, certainly in my lifetime, has not really understood it. So they think they can succeed by knocking out a leader who understands something and has courage that the rest of the population doesn't have. And that's enough for them. What we could knock out one of their bad guys, but their ideology is still there. Their institutions, their system is still there. They're just going to come up with other bad guys to do this. We have to defeat their institutions. We have to defeat their ideology. That's the only way we're going to stop them. Now, people who commit crimes do have to face justice. But the way that you're going to defeat them is to defeat both their institutional power and their ideological power.
Yeah, and take all their money away from them. Bank them in the process. And bankrupt them in the process. Yeah. So like Stephen King, for example, needs to be sued into, no matter how many times he apologizes, he needs to be sued into bankruptcy. I mean, that's serious. And then all the money donated to charity.
What did he apologize about?
He was being horrific and saying terrible things about Charlie Kirk after he died. Like, and to the level of libel, and he knows it was. That's why he apologized. Because his lawyers were like, dude, you can't say that. Your estate is at risk now. And yeah, like all of these people that are losing their jobs, you know, docs are losing their jobs. I got news for you. We're not going to fight this back. Taking it, they think they understand us. I want you I'm gonna get a little biblical here. They think on these globalist sons of bitches, they think they understand us. They think that we'll just, you know, roll over and play dead like we always have in the past because we don't want to stoop to their level. I got news for you. Shame works both ways, folks. The whole BDS, the, you know, BDS movement of, you know, boycott, divest, right? That works both ways. And it's going to, and it's no longer going to be enforced only in one direction, right? So, you know, and things happened in the past. We wanted to raise money for uncomfortable truths, you know, like the people getting wiped out in North Carolina, and then people set up, you know, GoFundMes and whatnot to help these people, and they all get shut down by GoFundMe because GoFundMe doesn't want to, you know, help MAGA. Well, fuck you. You're not gonna have a business soon. Okay, you want to cheer Charlie Kirk twerk on TikTok and cheer the assassination of a peaceful political commentator? Sorry, you don't get to work anymore. You don't get to work at Starbucks anymore. Like, you don't. We're gonna find you. And this is happening, and it's going to continue happening. They dox our people. They like, I just saw another thing the other day. Like this afternoon, the dumbasses in Chicago tried to stop an ICE raid and pulled a gun and started a violent confrontation, shot an ICE agent, who then, and he got shot. And I'm like, oh, well, that's really smart. You just gave Trump literal constitutional excuse to roll hot to Chicago and start cleaning the place up. Are you stoned? Do you want to win? Because you're not acting like now you want to win. Now you're just acting like a bunch of feral children. And sadly, at some point, there's going to come a point where everybody is just going, okay, well, this is it. Firm but fair. We're no more. we're not going to turn into the Fremen and kill all your children and their children's children and sow the ground with salt behind you. Just going to, like, that's enough. We're done. Sit down and shut up. It's going to take a lot of work. But that's why I said earlier about why the murals of Arena idea is such a powerful idea, because it keeps people grounded in this is why we are going to change this. And we're going to do it with not malice, but in memory of what was done wrong. And I want that model everywhere. But at times it's going to have to be a little bit of that's enough. And I hate to say it, but that's where we are. You didn't want it. You didn't want to. But what you really don't want is the sleeper to really awaken. I keep going back to Dune on this because Herbert saw the future. And I've been rereading all of that. And I'm like, and even the later books, which are almost unreadable, but the ideas and the projections of where societies go after these kinds of spasms. It's, okay. It's very interesting. It's very, very interesting. So,
but Tom, just your mention of the murals of Irina reminded me of the painting by Banksy on the Royal Courts of Justice, and how the people who don't know about it, a judge beating a protester who's lying prostrate on the ground, beating with his gavel, and then the following day it was covered over and guarded by two security guards, and then the following day somebody came along and they scrubbed off the wall, but the stain still remains.
So interestingly enough, I think I told the story. I was on a podcast yesterday. I told the story. So after the Gainesville murders back in the early 1990s, some of you might remember when we had the killing spree in Gainesville, Florida, my hometown. I was living in Gainesville at the time. I lived north of Gainesville now. You know, there's a section of 34th Street in Gainesville. It's one of the major arteries in Gainesville, where there's a retention wall, which all the graffiti artists would use for years, and they would, you know, and it was like a thing. And it's almost like the community art project, but it would constantly morph and change over time, and it was a thing. Along that stretch of road in 34th Street in Gainesville, not only did one of their rare acts of actual humanity, the Gainesville City Commission planted a whole bunch of palm trees with plaques for each of the names of the victims of the murders. And across, this is right across the street from what we call the 34th Street Wall. And there was a mural, and there was a tribute to that event. For like 15 years, if not longer, no one painted over that section of the wall. Mm-hmm. I haven't noted the 34th Street wall because I rarely get to Gainesville anymore. I tell, dude, I'm not allowed to leave my house because I'm barely fit for human consumption. So, but when I like the next time I go down, I travel down 34th Street, which is a road I never want to travel down because it's a mess. But I wouldn't be shocked if it's still there. Mm-hmm. If is what I'm getting at. That kind of respect, you know, is still there. This is the kind of thing, never again, is the kind of thing that we have to get into our heads. And we have to get into our heads in a way that we never lose our humanity in the process of saying never again.
Right.
And that's why we have to effectively grow our way out of it, succeed our way out of it. That positive identity, that out of horror, can we build greatness? And if we can do that, and if that's the lesson we take away from all of this. And it's interesting, like today I spent, before we got on the air, I watched more Charlie Kirk snippets in this afternoon than I'd watched in 5 years. And I was reminded of, you know, there were times when, you know, he kind of shot the bed or whatever, but most of them on balance were, no, we're going to have an open debate about what's right and wrong.
Yeah.
And that's fair. Yeah. And that's not worthy of death under any circumstance. Absolutely. And I hope a lot of people realize that. And I hope a lot of people have had their little memetic collapse that they were in a cult and that they're no longer in the cult and we need to move forward.
Absolutely. Thank you. Thank you. Anything else, guys, you want to talk about before we finish up? Okay. I'll take that as a no. What I would like each of you to do is just to say a little bit about where people can find you.
All right. Well, you can go to PrometheanAction.com. That's our newsletter. And find pretty much everything we do.
Very good. Alex?
iSystem Trend Compass on Substack, daily market trend following newsletter. My second publication is Alex Craner's Trend Compass. Alex Craner's Substack. And I'm active on X. My handle is @NakedHedgy.
Yes. Tom?
Palmalongo.me, where you can find the releases for each of the Gold Guts and Guns newsletters every month, along with releases for each of the new podcasts that they're trying to put out about 4 or 5 times a month. And, you know, Patreon.com/Gold Guts and Guns, where the whole service is available to you. And, of course, the worst version of me being very naughty every day, as Rich pointed out, at TFL 1728.
So. He's so rude. but
well, some people say quick-witted, but you know.
I'm English. You're rude.
And
okay, guys, thank you so much. You know, I've been taking some notes while you've been talking, and there's so many gems from each of you about what you've said. So many little pearls of wisdom. And I think you know, what you all provide as a group and individually with your respective platforms is just really, really important and vital information to, so that we all have a better understanding of the world, which gives us freedom and power and knowledge to be able to operate in it and ensure that we remain free and we leave that legacy for our children. So thank you so much. It's just a joy and a treat. I look forward to our next conversation in a month's time. Although I have had a suggestion. Can you have them on every week?
So much. But I want to say also, Rich, I think, you know, on the last thing out the door, that I've been, you and I have been friends for an awfully long time now. It's been a great honor and a great privilege to watch you as a host and presenter and everything else. Really, you're helping us move the needle. And I just want to, you know, I want to acknowledge that, because I don't think you ever get that kind of credit. And like, I get it come back to me through other people all the time. Like, Rich is such a lovely person. I'm like, yeah, he is. And he's doing unbelievable work. And I just want to make sure that everybody knows that I see that and I care about it. And I think it's important. So knowing how hard it has been for you, having been so friggin' shadow banned for so long, and how hard it's been for you. So I really appreciate your dogged determination and how you've leveled up over the years. It's been quite impressive. So
thank you. I got it. I want to say something to you, Tom. I was going to say it after, but I worked out that Trump is putting the sanctions on India in order to push India away from the Brits. And I worked that out before you said so. So I'm learning after all these years. I'm finally.
My work here is done, my friend. I can do this job from home and often do.
Okay. Thank you, guys. Thank you. All right.
All right, guys.
All the best. Bye-bye.
Take care. Bye-bye.